Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
I'm Joanna Shank.
I'm Emma Taylor.
And this is Murder, She Spoke. Emma, how are you?
I'm very well. We are firmly into the new year now. Things are very exciting. I am getting a puppy soon, which I've been waiting for a very, very long time. So yeah, that's very exciting. I will tell you all more about him when he arrives, but just a little spoiler. So yeah, expect me to talk nonstop about a puppy. I'll be like one of those parents with a new baby that just watch up and everyone's trying awkwardly.
He's really advanced for his age.
Oh God, I know. He's so clever. Do you know, he is so clever. Do you know, he went to the toilet by himself. By himself.
None of the other boys or girls in the class did that. It was just mine. Like, he knew what to do.
And I said, sit. And do you know what? He just sat down. I said, sit. And he sat. Is that not the most amazing thing? You'd be like, oh my God, Emma, shut up already.
But would you like to see a picture of him? I've got 10 million on my phone.
I mean, I already do that with the cats, so no one's going to be remotely surprised if I do that. It's just another fluffy thing for me to show people. So yeah, very exciting. Also, I fell into a random thing where I was recommending an app on, I don't know, Facebook, TikTok, something like that. And it was like, do you like to solve mysteries? And I was like, do I?
Yes. Do I ever?
Hello, targeted advertising. I'm here. You got me. So I've actually got three apps that were recommended to me. So one is called Unread. It's just not, it's not spelled fully. It's a bit annoying. It's the title of it is UNRD, which is a bit annoying. However, it's like a text story mystery.
Right.
So the girl goes missing, but it's in real time. So you get, so when you open the app, it's like you're in her phone.
Right.
You can listen to her calls, you can listen to her voicemails, you can go through her emails, you can look through her pictures and like find out about the dramas in her life and stuff like that. And, you know, there's this weird guy that she went on a Tinder date with that won't leave her alone, but there's some family drama, but she might be having an affair with her friend's boyfriend. And then she goes missing after a night out.
Right.
And there's messages from her like asking to meet someone at the park in the middle of the night. And you've got to try and work out what's going on. And you can only unlock certain conversations. So you have to decide carefully what conversations you want to unlock and pictures you want to unlock. Because some of them, you'll unlock it and it's just nothing. You're like, oh, I've just wasted.
Red herring.
Obviously, they're trying to get you to spend money because you can buy coins to open things. But there's also a chat where people kind of share things that they've opened. So you can kind of go through it with them as well. So that one's quite good.
Is this why you haven't been playing Harry Potter very much?
Yeah, that as well. I've been, I do
like, come on, Emma, it's the Christmas holidays. Where are the trophies for our team?
I got on a really hard level and it was bugging me. So
I was like, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it anymore. I give up.
It's just so rubbish. I get so grumpy when I get in a hard level. I feel really thick and I'm like, right, that's it. I'm being bested by a game built for children. This is not for me.
Oh, it's not for children.
It's far too advanced. No, but for real, I am coming back. Don't worry. Yeah.
Aces.
So another one that's similar is called Duskwood. And it's another kind of text-based one. I've only just downloaded that, but I've heard good things. So if you like creepy mysteries and you want to solve them on your phone, I believe you can pretty much do it all for free. You don't have to buy the coins and things like that, but some people do to mm-hmm. speed up the process. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's that one. And then another one, which isn't really remotely true crime or mystery related, but is good, is called GeoGuessr.
Right.
And it plonks you down in the middle of somewhere on Google Maps and you have to guess where you are in the world, or you can pick like a continent, or you can pick, you know, like famous places or historical landmarks, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you guess where you are, you put a pin on the map, and then you get points based on how close you are. So that was good fun for people that like geography or travel, because we can't travel right now. So why not do it on an app? Mm-hmm. So yeah, those three were Unread. So UNRD, GeoGuessr, which is geo and then guesser without the E again. Why we're just hating vowels today, I don't know. And then Duskwood. So yeah, three apps if you want to waste some of your very precious time. So there you go.
Brilliant.
How about you? Any recommendations, or do you just have a fabulous case for us?
Yeah, no recommendations from me this week, but today is a lengthier case, so I'm going to jump into it shortly. So it's just a heads up for anyone who, you'll have seen the length of the episode before you listened, but it had to be a long case to do it justice, so hopefully you're all okay with that. I know we usually keep our episodes to sort of between 30 and 40 minutes, so I'll try and keep it concise, but it might be a bit of a longer one today, but it's one that I have, I was toying with the idea of doing it, and I was like, it is a little bit rogue.
Let me guess, the person once visited Scotland. Is it one of those?
It's not actually. Okay, so I'll give you a clue. So the person was Scottish.
Okay.
And there is murder involved. Okay. So does it qualify?
Yeah, definitely qualifies. Absolutely. Okay. We'll take
amazing.
It.
Amazing. So the case I'm covering today is Mary, Queen of Scots.
Oh, nice. Yeah, love it.
Do you know what? I have had a sort of mild fascination with Mary, Queen of Scots for a while, but didn't know a huge amount about her. Then I watched the film Mary, Queen of Scots with Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie in a while ago and loved it. Which I know some people might be like, ugh, you know, rubbish, da-da-da, whatever, have their own opinions. But I really, really liked it. I thought it was great. And it was on again recently, and I thought, I had been toying with the idea of covering it, and then the film came on, and I thought, it's a sign, I need to do it.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true
and,
crime.
And, you know, like, strong female sort of person, and I just thought, yeah, it's much older than any of the cases we've covered before, but it was actually really enjoyable to research, which sounds incredibly sad, but I learned a lot, and I'm very interested in it because if anyone else is like me, I don't know a huge amount about the royal family or how they're all descended or all that kind of stuff, so it was all quite fascinating for me. So hopefully you'll enjoy it too.
I was going to say, I'm afraid you've found a fellow Mary Queen of Scots enthusiast, because my gran is from, well, lives in Linlithgow. And
yes.
She was at Linlithgow Palace for a good long time. So there's a lot in the kind of tour at Linlithgow about Mary Queen of Scots. I do know a bit, but I have to say it's been quite a while since my gran dragged me round and told me all the things. So I'm looking forward to hearing it again. So let's do this.
Well, one thing I will say before I start is I've never been to Linlithgow Palace, but I've wanted to go for a long time, and I definitely will be going now just so I can hear more about it. I'm hoping that, I mean, obviously there was a lot of source material, so I've kind of had to abbreviate a lot to try and get it into fit an episode, because obviously this is our whole life. So I do apologise if there's any key things that people, you know, if there's any history teachers or anyone listening to this that thinks, oh my god, you've done this a complete injustice, I do apologise, but I wanted to cover it, I wanted to fit it into an episode, so it's not a comprehensive review of her whole life, so just some highlights. So
I mean, just, we'd be here for days and weeks possibly, so let's just do the highlights.
Exactly.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Life in Scotland in the late 15th and early 16th century would have been very different to life today as we know it. During this time, Europe was going through a period of cultural change, which is now referred to as the Renaissance period. Art, literature, politics, philosophy, science, music, technology, religion and architecture were changing. So it was really kind of moving out of the Middle Ages and people were just becoming more learned in lots of different things and attitudes were changing. And it was just, as you know, when I go through the highlights, there'll be key things that you'll be able to build a picture in your mind of what kind of time we're talking about. So in 1492, the Americas were discovered by the white man. I've put that in specifically because the Americas weren't discovered in 1492. They were discovered by Christopher Columbus in 1492, but they already existed. There was already natives there, so... That's why I said that specifically. Okay, just a caveat. In 1495, Aberdeen University was founded and Leonardo da Vinci painted The Last Supper. In 1496, the Education Act was passed in Scotland, which required landowners to send their eldest sons to school to study Latin, arts and law. This made schooling compulsory for the first time in the world. In 1503... Leonardo da Vinci painted the Mona Lisa. In 1507, following the invention of the printing press, the first press was set up in Edinburgh. In 1508, Michelangelo began painting the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. In 1509, Henry VIII became the King of England and married Catherine of Aragon, his elder brother Arthur's widow. In 1513, the Battle of Flodden was fought between Scotland and England in Northumberland, leading to an English victory and the death of King James IV of Scotland. James IV and Margaret Tudor, who was King Henry VIII's sister, their son, James, became king at just 17 months old. He became King of Scotland. In 1517, Martin Luther, a German monk and professor of moral theology at the University of Wittenberg, Germany, I'm not sure if it's pronounced that right, nailed the 95 Theses to the door of the All Saints Church in Wittenberg. The 95 Theses challenged the power of and the corruption within the Roman Catholic Church. This is believed to have ignited the beginnings of the Reformation, which led to Catholicism being replaced with Protestantism in Scotland in the following years. So just a very brief overview for anyone that doesn't know much about this outside of Scotland. It was previously a Catholic country and this basically ignited the beginnings of challenging the Roman Catholic Church's actions. And the Reformation took place up until around 1560 when it was basically declared a Protestant land.
If we're going to be entirely historically correct, prior to that, even, it was pagan and Norse.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yes.
It was briefly a Catholic country in the grand history of Scotland. There was a period of time in which it was Catholic and then became Protestant.
Yes. Thank you. So, in 1525, King Henry VIII sought to have his marriage to Catherine of Aragon annulled. They had one daughter, but the marriage had not resulted in the birth of any living sons. And at the time, there was no established precedent for a woman on the throne. Pope Clement VII refused to annul the marriage between Catherine of Aragon and King Henry VIII. And so in 1534, Henry VIII separated the Church of England from the Catholic Church of Rome so that he could divorce Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn. In 1558, Elizabeth I became the Queen of England. So she was the daughter of Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII. In 1560, the Papal Jurisdiction Act was passed. It stated, "The Papal Jurisdiction Act 1560 is an act of the Parliament of Scotland which is still in force. It declares that the Pope has no jurisdiction in Scotland and prohibits any person from seeking any title or right to be exercised in Scotland granted under the authority of the Pope on pain of proscription, banishment and disqualification from holding any public office or honour." So that marked the end of the Reformation of Scotland, which was now a predominantly Protestant land. Now, Mary Queen of Scots, as she was well known, was her real name was Mary Stuart, so she was from the Stuart family. So following the death of their infant sons in 1541, the Scottish King James V and Mary of Guise had a child named Mary at Linlithgow Palace on the 8th of December 1542. James's uncle, King Henry VIII of England, urged James to break from the Roman Catholic Church as he had done, but James refused. Shortly afterwards, James's army suffered a serious defeat at the Battle of Solway Moss. He took ill soon after this and died when Mary was 6 days old on the 14th of December 1542. So Mary ascended to the throne while she was still a baby following her father's death. Now, King Henry VIII tried to secure a marriage between Mary and his son Edward. However, the French also wanted to secure a marriage for Mary. Following Mary of Guise's refusal to King Henry VIII, he declared war, which was later referred to as the Rough Wooing. It took place from 1543 until 1551. During this time, Edward ascended to the English throne following his father's death in 1547. Edward was just 9 years old when he became king. So at this point, Mary of Guise sent five-year-old Mary to France to be raised by King Henry II and Catherine de Medici. During this time, until her return in 1561, James Stuart, the first Earl of Murray, acted as regent. James was the illegitimate child of King James V and his mistress, Lady Margaret Erskine, so he was naturally Mary's half-brother. In April 1558, Mary married Dauphin of France, Francis II, who was King Henry and Catherine de Medici's son. So she'd been sent over there aged five to live with them, be brought up with them, and she essentially was betrothed to their son. Francis ascended to the throne in 1559, but he died in 1560 at just 16 years old. So during his reign, Mary was Queen Consort of France. Now, during this time as well, and also in 1558, but in November, Elizabeth Tudor ascended to the English throne. Now, many English Catholics refuted Elizabeth I as the rightful queen due to the daughter of King Henry VIII, due to being the daughter of King Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn. So because King Henry VIII's second wife, Anne Boleyn, and a former lady-in-waiting to his first wife, the English Catholics believed that the marriage was invalid and saw Mary as the lawful queen because they didn't believe the marriage was lawful because he hadn't been granted a divorce. So she was
illegitimate in their eyes. Yeah,
that's it. So as Margaret Tudor, sister of King Henry VIII, was Mary's grandmother, Mary was next in line to the English throne after Elizabeth. So she had a claim to the Scottish throne, but she also had a claim to the English throne as well, because she had Tudor blood.
Yeah, she's a double threat, really, at that point, isn't she?
Absolutely.
And she's Roman Catholic.
Exactly. She's Roman Catholic. The Reformation's happened. It's now predominantly Protestant. She's probably reluctantly accepted that, but she's refused to relinquish her own faith, so she's still keeping her Catholic faith. But yeah, so that's where we're at with things. So you can kind of see, you can see where this is going. So in 1561, at age 18, Mary returned to Scotland from France and arrived in Leith in August of that year. She was described as slender, with red hair and amber eyes. Listen to this, Emma. She was 5'11" tall.
Yeah. It's now, really odd at that time to be that tall. She was extraordinarily tall for a woman.
Yeah, which I never knew she was that tall. And I mean, that is tall for a woman now, even. But at that time in Scotland, that must have been practically unheard of.
Yeah, there's some statues of her, and there is one at the Linlithgow Palace, and I know it's the style at the time, but she just looks rather unusual, is probably the nicest way of putting it. So yeah, okay. You can Google them, have a look. Anyone that wants to Google statue of Mary Queen of Scots, and you'll see what we mean.
Yeah. So basically, she's 5'11" and she's tall. They must have just been looking at her thinking, who are you?
With the French
tall,
accent as
slender,
well.
French woman, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah,
it must have been really bizarre at that time. So although she was, as I say, she was forced to accept the outcome of the Reformation that made Scotland a Protestant land, she didn't abandon her faith. So she remained a faithful Roman Catholic. So 4 years later, in July 1565, Mary married her half-cousin, Henry Stuart, Lord Darnley, who was also a Tudor descendant. So she's just doubled down her, you know, link to the English throne. She's a Tudor descendant. She's married her half-cousin, who's also a Tudor descendant. Like, she's just making that bond. Do you know what I mean? She's just making that link even stronger by doing this.
And it will be political. It will be political in nature. There's no way that's accidental.
100%. I mean, this is a time where, you know, parents essentially decided who their children were going to marry before the children were even born, or while the children were still babies. Like, you know, it was all for gain and political reasons. And it wasn't just, hey, you meet someone, you fall in love and just get married. Like,
you don't marry for love in those days, do you?
And no. You marry for position. And
it's especially telling that, you know, there was an agreement between England and Scotland to get like, right, play nicely. We're all going to play nicely.
Calm down.
Mary's like, okay, but what if I don't?
Yeah, exactly.
Don't mind me. Just going to marry my half cousin to make things really awkward.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Lord Darnley was said to have been jealous of the friendship between David Rizzio and Mary, Queen of Scots. Now, David Rizzio was Mary's private secretary and confidant and close friend. Now, I don't know whether there was any accuracy to this or if it was just for, you know, dramatization or entertainment purposes. But if you've watched the film, they paint David Rizzio as possibly gay.
Yeah, that's been alluded to throughout history, but I don't know if they can prove it anyway.
Yeah, so I can't obviously say whether that is accurate or completely. Yeah. Not sure, but that just to give everyone a heads up, that's what was sort of portrayed in the film. Okay, so he was a private secretary and confidant, close friend. Now, rumours circulated that Rizzio had impregnated Mary, and Lord Darnley joined in a conspiracy of Protestant nobles to murder him, led by Patrick Ruthven, the third Lord Ruthven. So in March 1565, Mary was having dinner with Rizzio and a few ladies-in-waiting. Then Darnley joined them, accused his wife of adultery, and then had a group of nobles murder Rizzio, who was hiding behind Mary. Mary was held at gunpoint and Rizzio was stabbed numerous times. His body apparently took 57 dagger wounds. Now, the murder was the catalyst of the downfall of Darnley and had serious consequences for Mary's subsequent reign. So 3 months later, in June 1566, Mary gave birth to a son, who she also named James, at Edinburgh Castle. Despite the birth of their first child, the relationship between Mary and Henry did not improve, and she held a meeting at Craigmillar Castle in Edinburgh in November 1566 with leading nobles on how to deal with the matter. Shortly before Christmas the following month, their son was baptised and Henry stayed on his father's estates, presumably in fear for his life because his son's been born, he's now been baptised, and I can only imagine that he knew what was kind of destined for him. Now, apparently on the journey to his father's estates, he became unwell, and that lasted for several weeks. So they're not sure if it was a fever, if he'd been poisoned. You know, it's just one of those things that you don't know.
I think you've got a target on your back at that point in time if you are. It's, you know what, we laugh about Game of Thrones and series like that, but actually, you know, it really wouldn't surprise you to find out that, you know, at these points in time, you're only royal for as long as you're allowed to be, and often your life doesn't end the way that you would expect it to. I think it's, not many of them died of old age in their beds.
Yeah, life was a lot less meaningful, you know, like you know, people were like a lot more disposable. You know,
yeah, life was cheap. Life was cheap.
That was it. Life was cheap. A lot of people died young. You know, women were only really looked upon to produce male heirs, you know, all that kind of thing. So just a completely different time. But you're right. I mean, like Game of Thrones, though people might enjoy it or, you know, laugh at it, like, yeah, it's, I can imagine that nobody was safe from being conspired against.
That's why if you have if you go to these Renaissance fairs, you don't really want to be the princess. You want to be the woman, you know, running in a meadow, who's a shepherdess with, you know,
skirts flying.
Yeah, skirts flying, and she's just churned some butter, and she's just, you know, living a simple life, and the grass is beneath her bare feet. You don't want to be in the robes in the palace. You really, really don't.
No, definitely not. No. So, as I say, he became unwell on the journey. So whether he had got a fever or someone tried to poison him, whatever happened, he got poorly, and that lasted for several weeks. So in January of the following year, 1567, Mary encouraged Henry to return to Edinburgh, and he stayed at the house at Kirklefield with Mary visiting him daily. Now, on the night of February the 9th, 1567... the house at Kirklefield on the outskirts of Edinburgh, where Darnley lay recovering from illness, was blown up, and Darnley was strangled while trying to escape. Many theories have been put forward to explain conflicting accounts of the crime, including the possibility that Darnley, plotting to blow up Mary, was caught in his own trap. Nevertheless, it's most likely that the nobles who hated Darnley were responsible for his death. Now, Elizabeth I, who was the Queen of England, she was the daughter of Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII, the one that the many Catholics deemed to be the illegitimate child and therefore not the rightful queen. They believed that Mary, Queen of Scots, was the rightful queen. She wrote to Mary about the rumours that circulated following Lord Darnley's death. And an excerpt of one is as follows. "I should ill fulfil the office of a faithful cousin or an affectionate friend if I did not tell you what all the world is thinking. Men say that, instead of seizing the murderers, you are looking through your fingers while they escape, that you will not seek revenge on those who have done you so much pleasure, as though the deed would never have taken place had not the doers of it been assured of impunity. For myself, I beg you to believe that I would not harbour such a thought."
Oh my goodness. That's okay. So bitchy, isn't it?
Yeah, so this is like proper Game of Thronesy, so...
Yeah, yeah. I love it. Yeah, I love the wording, because nowadays we've only really changed the words that we use, really, haven't we?
Yeah,
like, you know, there's someone out there that's like, look, you didn't hear this from me, but, and I don't think this, honestly, I really don't think this, but everyone is saying that you totally, like, said
you totally
did kill
this.
My husband.
You can trust me. You can tell
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
I won't tell
fine.
Anyone.
I'm your cousin and I'm your friend. I promise. You can tell me anything. Ugh, Elizabeth. Come on, Elizabeth.
So, Lord Bothwell. So by the end of February 1567, so Darnley had died on the 9th of February. So this is by the end of that month, Bothwell was generally believed to be guilty of Darnley's assassination. Now, Lennox, who was Darnley's father, demanded that Bothwell be tried before the Estates of Parliament, to which Mary agreed. But Lennox's request for delay to gather evidence was denied. In the absence of Lennox, and with no evidence presented, Bothwell was acquitted after a 7-hour trial on the 12th of April. A week later, Bothwell managed to convince more than 24 lords and bishops to sign the Ainslie Tavern Bond, in which they agreed to support his aim to marry the Queen. Mary visited her son at Stirling from the 21st to the 23rd of April 1567. So the 7-hour trial where Bothwell was acquitted happened on the 12th of April. Then the Ainslie Tavern Bond was signed, okay? So this is just 10, 11 days later. So Mary visited her son at Stirling. And then when returning to Edinburgh on the 24th of April, she was abducted by Lord Bothwell and his men and taken to Dunbar Castle. On the 6th of May, they returned to Edinburgh and were wed under Protestant rites 9 days later. Lord Bothwell had divorced his former wife 12 days earlier. Now, the marriage of a Catholic and a Protestant was not viewed favourably by people of either branch of the Christian faith, and many were surprised that Mary had wed the man.
You mean the man that kidnapped her with men and took her to a castle? And well, also had a bunch of lords say, yeah, it's cool, we agree with you, you can just marry her, go nuts.
Going to have a little caveat to that in a second, but okay. Obviously the Catholics didn't agree with the terms of the marriage because it had been carried out under Protestant rights. So for them, they were just like, doesn't mean a damn thing, it's not valid, you know, basically it didn't happen. It's not valid. But it's worth noting at this point that it's not clear how much say Mary had in the events that transpired. There was a suggestion that she might have been subjected to rape by Lord Bothwell after being taken to Dunbar Castle, and they can't prove whether she went willingly or unwillingly. Do you know what I mean? So it's like,
yeah,
I could have gone and read and read and read to try and find, you know, evidence in support of either argument, but it's just worth putting the question out there that she was a woman. She was a widow at 18. She come to the country. Lord Darnley had been murdered. Whether she was at the, you know, behind that or not, then this is shortly after. She has a son. He is due to become the King of Scotland on her death, and the King of England. So
yeah,
there's a lot going on, and she's Catholic. She's in a Protestant land, and this guy is Protestant.
Additionally, so say she was behind Lord Darnley's murder, that Lord Bothwell knows all about that and could use that to his advantage. Say she wasn't behind it and he was, now she has someone who she knows for a fact is a murderer who has kidnapped her and also has gained the approval of dozens of lords to marry her. What is she actually going to do? What is she going to do?
Exactly. So yeah, it's just worth bearing in mind that I don't want to try and lean it either way. To me, I don't know enough about it. Obviously, historians do an enormous amount of research. I'm sure that there would be a strong argument in favour of one way or the other, but I don't know what that is. So I'm just a caveat, just to give you that information. To anyone who's actually interested in the details of this, that just, you know, wants to sort of paint a picture in their head and come to their own conclusions. So Protestant nobles united against Mary and Bothwell and eventually met Mary and Bothwell's army at the Battle of Carberry Hill on the 15th of June 1567. So this is only 2 months later. Mary surrendered, her troops deserted her, and Bothwell fled. The lords took Mary to Edinburgh, where crowds of spectators denounced her as an adulteress and a murderer. The following night, she was imprisoned in Loch Leven Castle on an island in the middle of Loch Leven. Between the 20th and the 23rd of July, Mary miscarried twins. On the 24th of July, Mary was forced to abdicate in favour of her one-year-old son, James. Mary's natural half-brother, James Stuart, the first Earl of Murray, who had been the regent in charge
previously,
in Scotland,
previously
when she was a child in France, he was made regent, while Bothwell was driven into exile. Now, Bothwell was apparently imprisoned in Denmark, became insane, and died in 1578. So, it's very quick demise after that all transpired. But the same couldn't be said for Mary. So, in 1568, Mary escaped Loch Leven Castle and raised an army of 6,000 men. They fought Murray's forces at the Battle of Langside on the 13th of May, but lost. So as a result, Mary fled to England seeking refuge with Elizabeth I, who was her first cousin. Elizabeth wanted to get to the bottom of the matter of Lord Darnley's death and the actions of the Confederate lords, and so she ordered an inquiry, or a conference as it was known at that time, was held in York and later Westminster between October 1568 and January 1569. Now, during this conference, the casket letters were produced by Mary's half-brother, the first Earl of Murray, who was playing regent in Scotland in her absence. Now, he produced those letters as evidence of her affair with Lord Bothwell. Now, the reason they were called the casket letters were simply just because they were found in a silver casket with engravings on them. Now, the casket letters were 8 letters supposedly written by Mary to Bothwell, as well as 2 marriage contracts, and a love sonnet or sonnets. Now, all of the letters were unsigned. And also, I think we've mentioned it in an earlier episode, but just in case you don't know, marriage contracts were different back then. There was something to do with if you wrote a letter sort of committing to marriage between people, it could be upheld, couldn't it? It could be seen as like a legal...
It could be upheld. Yeah, could be. It wasn't the same kind of marriage contract that you get nowadays. It was entirely different.
Yes. So that's just a caveat for anyone who's a little bit confused there about what that was about. So the two marriage contracts, that I'm assuming that's supposed to be a to him and from him, both betrothed to each other, essentially just a letter. So as I said, all of the letters were unsigned. Now, those letters have been the source of much controversy and apparently are now generally believed to be fake. At the time of their appearance, Mary asserted that they were forgeries and that her handwriting was not difficult to imitate. Now, just a little aside here, apparently the content of those letters, they don't exist in their entirety. There are parts of some of the letters, but others are you know, probably burned at the time or have gone missing since. Apparently there were paragraphs which didn't flow with the rest of the grammar, which looked like they could have been inserted by someone else, but there were other terms and phrases and wording used that was associated with Mary, so just to put that out there, okay? So the majority of the commissioners accepted that the casket letters were genuine at the time of the conference was held. After a study of their contents, as I said, and comparison of the penmanship with examples of Mary's handwriting. Now, Elizabeth concluded the inquiry with a verdict that nothing was proven against either the Confederate lords or Mary.
Interesting.
So she held this inquiry, essentially, and at the end of it, nobody was found to be guilty. It was like a not proven verdict, I think,
is what
I came to my head when I was researching it. I thought, you know, I wonder if that's where the not proven thing came from, because that's quite interesting. So anyway, for overriding political reasons, Elizabeth wished neither to convict nor to acquit Mary of murder. There was never any intention to proceed judicially. The conference was intended as a political exercise.
So it's to discredit her either way, because either way, whether she was found, it's the same with many things. You know, they joke that all press is good press, but it's not. Mm-hmm. If it's that, the evidence that comes out, even if it's not accepted, once it's heard, once it's out there, people know it.
Mudsticks.
It spreads like wildfire. Yeah, absolutely mudsticks. Absolutely.
In the end, Murray, the first Earl of Murray, who James Stuart, who was...
Mary's half-brother,
who was playing regent in Scotland. He returned to Scotland as regent, and Mary remained in custody in England. Now, Elizabeth had succeeded in maintaining a Protestant government in Scotland without either condemning or releasing her fellow sovereign. So she'd achieved quite a good task, so very, very political. Very political. So on the 26th of January 1569, Mary was moved to Tutbury Castle and placed in the custody of the Earl of Shrewsbury and his formidable wife, Bess of Hardwick. Elizabeth considered Mary's designs on the English throne to be a serious threat and confined her to Shrewsbury's properties, including Tutbury, Sheffield Castle, Sheffield Manor Lodge, Wingfield Manor and Chatsworth House, all of which were located in the interior of England, halfway between Scotland and London, and distant from all coasts. So she's basically put her right in the middle of Britain at the time, so that she couldn't escape. She was keeping an eye on her. She was keeping her right under her watchful eye, basically. So for the next 18 years, Mary was essentially held under house arrest, is what I would term it this, you know, today. She was only allowed outside under strict supervision, and she spent most of her time embroidering. Now, Thomas Howard, the fourth Duke of Norfolk, had chaired the commission at York, the conference or inquiry, that had seen neither anyone found guilty of anything. He chaired that commission. He'd schemed to set Mary free and marry her. Now, he briefly participated in the Rising of the North of 1569, which was also called the Revolt of the Northern Earls or Northern Rebellion, which was an unsuccessful attempt by Catholic nobles from Northern England to depose Queen Elizabeth I of England and replace her with Mary, Queen of Scots, because obviously they believed that she was the rightful queen.
Yeah.
The Duke of Norfolk was imprisoned by Elizabeth I in October 1569. Early the following year, in January, on the 23rd of January 1570, Murray, Mary's half-brother, who was playing regent in Scotland, he was assassinated in Linlithgow by James Hamilton of Bothwell Haw, a supporter of Mary. Now, as Murray was passing in a cavalcade in the main street below, Hamilton fatally wounded him with a carbine shot from a window of his uncle Archbishop Hamilton's house. He was the first head of government to be assassinated by a firearm.
That's interesting. I did not know that.
I didn't know that either. So, there you go. So, following the Duke of Norfolk's release in August 1570, so he was held in prison for about 9 months, I think, and then they let him go. After some hesitation, he participated in the Ridolfi Plot with King Philip II of Spain to put Mary on the English throne and restore Catholicism in England. Now, the plot was revealed to the Queen's minister, Lord Burghley, and after a trial in January 1572, in which he was found guilty unanimously, Norfolk was executed for treason in Tower Hill, London, in June of 1572. In 1584, so a couple of years later, Mary proposed an association with her son James. She announced that she was ready to stay in England and abandon her pretensions to the English crown. She also offered to join an offensive league against France. For Scotland, she proposed a general amnesty, agreed that James should marry with Elizabeth's knowledge, and accepted that there should be no change in religion. Her only condition was the immediate alleviation of the conditions of her captivity. Now, James went along with the idea for a while, but he eventually rejected it and signed an alliance treaty with Elizabeth, abandoning his mother. Elizabeth also rejected the association because she did not trust Mary to cease plotting against her during the negotiations.
I don't think I would trust someone that I'd kept locked up for 18 years either.
No, me neither. On the 11th of August 1586, so we're fast forwarding another couple of years here, after being implicated in the Babington plot, Mary was arrested while out riding. Mary had been misled into thinking that her letters were secure, whilst they were actually deciphered and read by Sir Francis Walsingham, who was known as the Queen's spymaster. Walsingham had discovered the plot and sought to entrap Mary to remove her as claimant to the English throne. So from these letters, it was clear that Mary had sanctioned the attempted assassination of Elizabeth. The long-term goal of the plot was the invasion of England by the Spanish forces of King Philip II and the Catholic League in France, leading to the restoration of the old religion. That final act led to Mary's death. She was tried at Fotheringay Castle in October 1586 for treason under the Act for the Queen's Safety before a court of 36 noblemen and found guilty. Mary denied the charges and said, "Look to your consciences and remember that the theatre of the whole world is wider than the Kingdom of England." She protested that she had been denied the opportunity to review the evidence, that her papers had been removed from her, that she was denied access to legal counsel, and that as a foreign anointed queen, she had never been an English subject, and thus she could not be convicted of treason.
I was just about to say that, and surely, the whole of history, different monarchs have conspired against each other, and when they go to war against each other, is that therefore somehow treason because they want to kill the other king or queen? Well, yes, of course they want to kill the other king or queen. They're at war with them. It makes absolutely no sense. Nonsense.
Yep. So, unfortunately, that didn't do the job. So Elizabeth hesitated to order Mary's death, but eventually relented, signing her death warrant on the 1st of February 1587 and entrusting it to William Davison, a Privy Councillor. On the 8th of February, so a week later, 1587, Mary was beheaded at Fotheringay Castle. Her last words were, I don't know Latin, Emma, so please correct me if I mispronounce this.
It's a dead language. No one knows how it's pronounced.
Okay. So
wild.
All right, okay, I'm just going to go nuts. So her last words were, "In manus tuus domine commendo spiritum meum," which means, "Into thy hands, O Lord, I commend my spirit." When news of Mary's execution reached Elizabeth, she was indignant and claimed that Davison had disobeyed her instructions to part with the warrant and the Privy Council had acted without her authority. Davison was arrested, thrown into the Tower of London and found guilty of misprision. Now, that's not misprison, it's misprision, okay? Ooh. Or misprision. Now, apparently that, I looked it up, that's apparently the deliberate concealment of one's knowledge of a treasonable act or a felony. Okay, so...
So was she trying to say that he knew he wasn't meant to kill Mary, but he did it anyway, so yeah. He's... Right, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Despite her having signed the death warrant.
Initially. Okay. She's trying to claim that she changed her mind. He was supposed to get rid of it and not...
No take-backsies.
But he did. So basically, he was released 19 months later, and Elizabeth was both... vague and had enough plausible deniability to not be directly blamed for Mary's demise. Okay?
Oh, no. So it's just like when you order something on Amazon and you go, oh, wait, actually, I've already got that. And then you go to cancel it, but they've already dispatched it. What a nightmare. I really could feel you, Elizabeth.
Yeah. So form your own opinions from that. So Mary was buried at Peterborough Cathedral in 1587 following a Protestant ceremony, which to me is just like spitting on her grave. Mm. It's really, just really disrespectful in my opinion. But anyway...
No, I totally agree. I think it's one of those things, beliefs are a very personal thing. And yeah. I think that a funeral or a celebration of life is one of those scenarios in which you go with what the person wanted and what they believed.
Exactly. So to me, yeah, just sounded like they were spitting on her grave. So just to add insult, you know, add insult to injury. So she was later moved to Westminster following exhumation in 1612. That instruction was given by her son, who was now King James VI of Scotland and First of England. So King James VI of Scotland, but also King James I of England is how that would,
yeah,
title would be. And she was interred in a chapel opposite the tomb of Elizabeth, who had died in 1603. Elizabeth's reign became known as the Elizabethan era, which is renowned for William Shakespeare, Christopher Marlowe, Francis Drake and Walter Raleigh. Some historians depict Elizabeth as a short-tempered, sometimes indecisive ruler. She was known as the Virgin Queen, who never married nor bore any children. Toward the end of her reign, a series of economic and military problems weakened her popularity. However, Elizabeth reigned as queen for 44 years and helped to forge a sense of national identity. Following the death of Elizabeth, Mary Queen of Scots' son became, as I said, both James VI of Scotland and First of England in the Union of the Crowns.
So you could say she got her comeuppance then, in a roundabout way.
She did, and just a little side note that from that point onwards, they've all been descended, you know, it's her line that's descended, yeah. Although she wasn't a man, but it's you know, it's her line that's, you know, ascended to the throne ever since then. From James, her son. So, yeah. So there's that, which is possibly, you know, some sort of conciliation. That is it. So that is my very brief, albeit long-winded for us, run-through of Mary, Queen of Scots, and her, you know, accusations of murder for her second husband held against her, and ultimately what led to her demise and downfall.
It's such a fascinating story. I mean, all of the ins and outs of, to be honest, all of the countries at that time, it's just amazing. And like you said, people were just pawns. They were just political in nature. If you were born a woman, then you were to give birth. And if you didn't produce an heir, you could be accidentally found in a loch somewhere, or, you know, fall off, yeah, a wagon. And yeah, there was a lot going on, and I think it must have been really, really difficult. I mean, she was less than a year old when she became
6 days queen.
Old. Sorry, yeah, that's right,
6 days old. So the time that she was sent to France was when King Henry VIII died. And his,
And she was betrothed to his son, Edward.
His son, Edward. So they had tried to arrange that was because, so Mary's mother was Mary of Guise. Mm-hmm. And from that, you've got French, Catholic, and associated with Spain. Yeah. Whereas in England, it was, the Tudors, and King Henry VIII had obviously taken over the church and, basically said, Roman Catholicism doesn't exist here anymore because I want a divorce. And so they were very firmly trying to get English rule. They didn't want Scotland to basically be given to, France or, Spain or whatever. They wanted to make sure that it was ruled.
But with that action, her parents essentially set all these motions in place, and she was never going to be safe from that point forward, I would say.
No.
From the English monarchy, she was never going to be safe.
I mean, definitely not. I feel that if the Reformation hadn't happened, it might have been different. And I mean, like, the Reformation is another thing that really kind of fascinates me, because I don't know a huge amount about it, and because there are echoes of this that still exist in Scotland, which a lot of people that don't...
Yeah, as we've spoken about before, a lot of people in Scotland don't know.
You've got the football teams, you've got, the Orange Walks, the celebration of Battle of the Boyne and all this stuff, and it's all to do with... I mean, we're talking back in the 16th century, and people are still firmly holding on to this stuff. I mean,
people are still murdering people over this today.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely, it's, in Scotland. So,
and around the world, to be fair, in Ireland as well, the differences between Catholicism and Protestantism, which I remember as a child asking naively, I mean, they both believe in God. What's the big deal? What's the differences? Yeah. And it was just, when you look at it from such a simplistic point of view,
you just don't stand.
Exactly.
And the crazy thing is, as well, Emma, is that they're both Christian religions. They're
absolutely
both Christianity. You're not talking about two different religions here. I mean, obviously, no. I don't want to go down this path and, cause any arguments or upset with our listeners, but it's the same. It's the same faith. It's a branch of the same faith. It's just you originally had the Protestantism. Basically, it branched off from Catholicism because they questioned certain actions and they wanted that break from Roman Catholics and things like that. So that's where it branched off from. Another point on Scottish history that I'm interested in learning more about is the Covenanters. I don't know really anything about that.
I think that'd be interesting to learn more about. Absolutely.
But also as well, in this story I mentioned King Henry VIII. For anyone who has a slight interest in history or the royals will probably recognise his name. He was a very, very well-known monarch, and I barely touched on him in this case, but he obviously wasn't Scottish, but you could go down a whole rabbit hole with him as well.
I nearly made a joke saying that didn't he murder like half his wife, so why did he even bother with the whole divorcing the first one?
Yeah.
He should have just killed her as well.
I knew that King Henry VIII had about six wives or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And I knew that they divorced or had them beheaded or whatever. What I didn't know was that his first wife he was actually married to for years. Mm. Years and years. I thought all his marriages were really brief.
Yeah, no, I had been aware of that, but I knew that it was just to do with the production of an heir.
Yes.
Which obviously is the most important thing, but perhaps that's why he wants to divorce her rather than have her taken care of in some way, if he genuinely cared for her. Perhaps I just recall, so from my youth I was really into like horrible histories and kind of creepy morbid. I'm sure you're all very surprised to hear this based on the podcast that we do, but I was very much into all that and knowing the gory details. I remember there's various songs and rhymes about Mary, Queen of Scots, got her head chopped off.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember those as well.
No.
But the actual story of her execution, she had a little dog under her coats, under her petticoats, yes, that came out after.
Yes.
And there was other bits that could, may or may not be true, but that she had a wig on that resembled mm-hmm. her former hair colour. And then when the head came off, the wig came off and she had short grey hair, which is no surprise because she was older. And then once about her lips moving half an hour or a quarter of an hour after the head was removed from the body, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I remember being fascinated and morbidly really into all that kind of stuff. So
curious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just one of those things.
Another thing which is I didn't mention because it just sort of made me feel a bit sad. I think I'm pro Mary. I think I'm very pro Mary, and it made me feel a bit sad. But apparently, you know, she from the accounts that I read, she was very graceful at the point where she's being beheaded. You know, she regained her composure to the end.
She forgave the executioner as well. She pardoned
She did. She said she pardoned the executioner. But one thing that did make me feel really sad was that the first blow didn't kill her. It hit the back of her head. And it was the second blow that actually beheaded her, although not completely. But yeah, that just made me feel quite sad because I just thought, what horrible fate anyway. And then, you know, to have people watching it and just the whole circumstance, it's very morbid, it's very sad, do you know what I mean?
It is, yeah.
And like you say, you know, people were disposable back then, life was cheap, and it doesn't surprise me that she's a figure that's remained a sort of quite fascinating figure in Scottish history. It's really, really interesting reading. I am absolutely 100% going to go and look up some more books. I can, you know, find out a bit more about it and do a bit more reading because as I get older, I seem to be totally geeking out on history stuff. And I'm really fascinated by it. So hopefully you enjoyed that episode. Apologies if you didn't.
I really did. I thought it was fabulous. I think there's so much to Scottish history and a lot of it is intrinsically linked with crimes and with murders, unfortunately. Like I said, you know, if you have royals, you will have murders usually. Yep. You will have intrigue, you will have affairs, you will have illegitimate children, and you will have, you know, arguments about everything. Exactly. So it's definitely something that you may hear more of, listeners. Jo, that was awesome. Thank you so much. We always love a historical case.
Yep. So glad you enjoyed it.
So I have a very much not historical and ridiculous story. Once again, this does involve injury to someone. We're not laughing at the injury, we're laughing at the story. It's not that deep. Florida man stabs woman in the head with a fork.
I knew it was going to be Florida man.
Why do you think
this elusive Florida man?
I know. Why do you think he stabbed her in the head with a fork? I'll give you one guess.
One guess. All right, okay. So I am going to guess that it was at like a fast food restaurant or something and he didn't get what he wanted.
Not that far off.
All right, okay. No. What was it?
So it was an undercooked potato. His name's Kenneth Crumpton, which, I mean, amazing, amazing name. And he stabbed a woman.
Are you sure he didn't just pop out of the story that I just told?
Honestly, yeah. Literally.
Could you imagine Sir Kenneth Crumpton, advisor to the Queen?
Is that total nonsense? Yeah, so he was really upset because I think it was meant to be a baked potato, but it was undercooked. And it is annoying. I'm not going to lie. It's a bit annoying if you think your potato's cooked, it's not cooked. Mm. You know, that is a bit frustrating. But I don't think I'd take a fork to the person.
No.
I'd maybe just whack it back in the oven or the microwave potentially. But then it's not crispy. So maybe that's where that kind of kicked off. And he's like, well, my beans are ready, but now my potato's not ready. I've had a hard day.
Oh, man, the cheese has already started melting and now I need to cook it again.
Do you know what I mean? It is quite frustrating.
So was he at home or was he out eating someplace?
It looks like he knew her. They're trying not to give you too much information.
Okay.
But he also stabbed her multiple times in the head with his fork, which interestingly is what I do to the potato before I cook it.
Yeah.
And so maybe that was related somehow. I don't know. Anyway, that's that.
I know, I shouldn't laugh. That's funny.
What bad man.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. When I
also
used to go to the...
Wait, did he only have a fork to hand? Because who only eats a potato with a fork?
Yeah, that's not real. You've got to have a knife if you're eating a baked potato.
I bet he's the kind of person that has sporks in his drawer.
Maybe. I do feel... Yeah, I'm not justifying his actions, but I do have to say, I used to get baked potatoes a lot from when I worked, you know, work cafeterias and stuff, because, you know, it's always a good lunchtime, you know, meal. When if I did get one that was undercooked, I was not. You just can't salvage it. I mean, you can try and mix it all up and mash it all up and add your filling, your tuna, your cheese,
it's
whatever.
Not good.
It just doesn't work. No. It's just not. It's so I can empathise with him, but I don't support his...
We don't endorse the stabbing.
No, I don't endorse the stabbing.
Please don't stab
forks. I can understand his frustration, yeah.
Oh, additionally, I would say, from the Mary Queen of Scots case, just another bit of a life tip from me. Mm-hmm. Don't marry someone if it's going to cause a battle, like, a month later. That just seems quite a basic... you know, pre-marriage guidance. Is this going to cause a battle where people will die? That's probably a no-go.
But did she willingly go into that marriage?
That's true. Or are we going to say, do marry someone that would go to battle for you?
Yeah.
I don't know. There's two ways of looking at that.
I'm definitely interested to read and learn more about that whole thing, because it sounds, by all intents and purposes, that she could have very easily been coerced into marrying him. You know,
I do enjoy how she
how
she managed to rouse a bunch of lords, though, like, to fight for her. I don't want to be a royal. I have no interest in that. But there's something very enticing about being able to, like, get people to fight for your
6,000 men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's quite fun. Even if it was just, like, to do your chores for you or something, you know, like, if you could just rouse them to, like, do whatever. Like, I don't necessarily need to go to battle, but I do have loads of DIY. I do, like, a good meal. My car could probably do with some work done. Gardening, hate gardening. And just general life stuff. Like, see, if you don't want to call and make an appointment. Yeah, like, I don't want to send that email, but I have 6,000 men. One of them will be able to do it. I think that'd be really good. Yeah, I think that'd be good.
I agree. I you know, I'd love it if men battled over, like, you know, like, want to cook for me or something. That would just be like,
do you know what?
That'd be like the dream.
I mean, we're just saying men because that's who she roused. Like, 6,000, anyone.
Oh yeah, anyone. Yeah,
anyone. Really.
I'd take that. Yeah. I wouldn't be fussy about it.
In fact, if
anyone wants to fight to do anything for me, then please let me know.
Although if I did have a full on choice, it would be an army of 6,000 woodland creatures, probably.
Oh, I thought you were going to say cats.
Well, cats live in the woodlands, so yeah, they would count. But yeah, no, like,
animals.
Woodland creatures, because you've seen how that works out for Disney princesses. You would get so much done in your life. So much. I mean,
no,
have you seen how well they can sew, for example? But Disney ones can talk half the time. I mean, I don't know if I do want that, actually.
Yeah, I think I'd prefer that they were silent.
Silent but efficient.
Gone off on a little bit of a tangent here.
Thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed this week's episode, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and or review on your podcast platform of choice. You can actually leave reviews on Spotify now. We have been reliably informed. So I believe you can rate us. I don't know what other information you can get, but on Podbean, you can leave little comments as well. And if you want to get in contact with us for any other reason, we've got an email address. It's info@murdershespoke.net. And you can contact us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for Murder, She Spoke podcast. Thanks again, and we'll see you in a week.